All right, is everybody admitted?
I'm sorry. Where is that again? All right, I gotta get you back on video. Hold on. Sorry.
All right. I think we are ready to call to order this calendar of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We apologize for a late start. Apparently, there are some issues with respondent's attorney joining us, but we will go ahead and proceed. So, Mr. Westrick, you're here on behalf of appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
Great. All right. And then everybody knows how to deal with remote oral arguments. If there's any issues, holler. If respondent's attorney is able to join us, because we know the notices went out and apparently there was some confusion at respondent's counsel's end. But we're going to go ahead and proceed. So with that, Marshall, do you want to go ahead and call the first case on our calendar?
Yes. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Smith, and Judge Hooten. The Honorable Susan L. Siegel presiding. Calling case 821-1526, Gabrielle Elizabeth Shanley, on behalf of the minor child respondent versus Justin James Osgood, appellant.
All right, Mr. Westrick. Please proceed when you're ready and first identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is John Westrick. I represent the appellant, Justin Osgood. There are two issues that we raised in our brief. One of them has dual facets, but the first issue is whether or not Minnesota Statute 634.20 applies in a civil case such as an order for protection. A prior decision of this court would seem to indicate that, and as well as the use of the word accused in the statute would seem to indicate that that statute only applies in criminal cases. So this court held in the Copeland decision that we've cited in our brief. And in this case, the trial court allowed, over our objection, admission of prior domestic abuse conduct against the child's mother that had been raised and testified to by her. The second issue that comes out of the 634.0 is there is some limiting language in the Supreme Court's language, State v. McCoy, that would indicate that this had to, one, be similar conduct, and two, even though the statute seems to indicate otherwise, that this has to be conduct directed at the person who is the quote-unquote victim of the acts complained of by the accused. And of course, here the acts that were discussed, I can see that Mr. Martin is in the waiting room. The issue that has been discussed, the acts were directed at the petitioner and not
Mr.
at-
Mr. Westrick, let's freeze the clock for a minute and allow Mr. Martin. Mr. Martin, welcome. Mr. Westrick is giving his argument. And then, as you know, you will have 15 minutes to respond. And then appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. So with that, Mr. Westrick, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Westrick, my apologies. And Your Honor, my apologies for interrupting. I was never given any information. We've checked.
Mr. Martin, I'm going to interrupt you. Our records show that notices of this hearing went out. Mr. Westrick is in the middle of his argument, and we're going to let him complete his argument, and then you will have 15 minutes for response. All right, Mr. Westrick, please continue.
Thank you, Your Honor. And so here, the evidence that was admitted was not directed towards the minor child, but was instead directed towards the petitioner in prior instances. And we believe that that was also an error. I have not seen many civil, maybe any civil statutes that use the word the accused. Maybe they're out there. Mostly the accused pops up in instances like this. The Constitution, the accused shall have the right to counsel. This is, again, a civil case. The second issue, which is, and I need to mention, the reliance of the trial court on this evidence indicates and shows to this court that it is not harmless error, that the court's reliance on this was a major facet and major basis for the court to do this. So we don't believe this is harmless error. The second
Mr. Westrick, how do you respond to the fact that the statute itself says evidence of domestic conduct by the accused against the victim or against any other family or household members? So how do you get around that provision? And we are dealing with the rule of evidence. I mean, the Minnesota Supreme Court has adopted this as a rule of evidence. So we are interpreting a statute, but it's also, you know, because of separation of powers issues, it's a rule of evidence.
It is, Your Honor. And I'll note first that the Copeland decision seems, and I note this in a footnote, that the decision in Copeland seems to fly in the face of these language of the statute. But I also notice in the McCoy case where the Supreme Court adopted this rule as a matter of comedy, it suggested that it would have to limit it. And it did limit it because it said it has to be, quote, similar conduct, end quote. And so I understand this is a rule of evidence, and I don't know how to get around it. I only know that prior cases interpreting the statute have indicated that it had to be directed at the victim and not at the victim's family, even though, as the court just pointed out, the statute would seem to say otherwise. And I was kind of confused by that, which is why I put in the footnote, this is kind of an odd thing here, because I wanted to point that out to the court. So I really can't explain the contradiction, to be frank. The second issue that I think is equally important is I do not believe there was sufficient evidence to find that Mr. Osgood, the appellant, committed domestic abuse. This court has said that in order to issue a domestic abuse order, one has to find that the person committed domestic abuse. No one testified that my client committed domestic abuse. There was no real evidence that my client committed domestic abuse. There were several caretakers. There was a sibling. There were all sorts of people there. And so even if this were a circumstantial case, no theory predominates. No one was there. And so our view is that there just was insufficient evidence whatsoever for the trial court to base this on. It was all based on conjecture and speculation and an inference, basically, that because he'd done this before, he must have done it now.
Can I ask you this? I mean, can't you prove this by circumstantial evidence and reasonable inferences from the facts that are proven?
Absolutely.
Correct and circumstantially?
You can prove it circumstantially, but if you're proving it circumstantially, your theory has to predominate over all other possibilities. And this theory doesn't predominate against all other possibilities.
Wouldn't it just be by a preponderance of the evidence? And also, isn't this also based on a credibility determination as to which, you know, as I think the judge indicated, there was some credibility issues with your client.
I understand the credibility issue. I'm not arguing that my client was more credible. I'm not arguing that somebody else wasn't credible. Even if all the witnesses for the petitioner were credible and all the witnesses for the appellant were not, so what? Because none of them...
Here's what, though, counsel. The child was injured. There was a limited number of people who were around the child. A district court could find that the child was injured by a person, not a doorknob, and that the that the other people who were there did not do it by virtue of credibility determinations.
I disagree with that, Your Honor.
And why? What's wrong with that?
Well, because the court has to, well, first of all, the petitioner has to show who did it. They don't get to say this happened on his watch.
Right, but you can say if there are three people around a child and the child ends up injured and no one witnessed it, no one else witnessed it except the person who did it, and then you don't believe one, but you believe the others who were there, why isn't that circumstantial evidence that one of them, the district court can decide without question the child was injured by a person based on the injuries to the child. It's just a matter of who. And if you make credibility determinations about and take into account timing and reaction and all that kind of thing, I don't understand. It seems to me to suggest that you think there needs to be an eyewitness to the actual moment of abuse.
No, there doesn't have to be an eyewitness, but there has to be something more than it happened on his watch. And that's really what I see the trial court made a finding here, because no one testified as to how the child was injured. No one testified that anybody did anything, and no one can say how the child was even injured. We don't know. Did the child get punched by a sibling? Did the child get hit by one of the caretakers? No one knows. And anyone who says anything for not being there is speculation. So for instance, if Mr. Osgood had been the only caretaker, the only person who had the child from, say, 5 p.m. until midnight, and the injuries were found at 12:10 in the morning, you would have a good circumstantial case that would predominate over any other theory because he was the only caretaker. But that's not what we have here. What we have here is he's one of three caretakers, and then there is also another sibling that was involved. And so we no one knows what happened. No one knows who did anything. And the fact that Mr. Osgood raised, I don't know, did she run into a doorknob? I don't think that his saying some theory that turns out not to be right is a sufficient basis for the court to say, aha, he did it. It's just not there. There's no evidence whatsoever, circumstantial or otherwise, that predominates, that directs everyone's attention to Mr. Osgood. And as a result, we believe that the evidence was insufficient. Are there any other questions? Because otherwise, I am finished with my initial presentation. All right. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Westrick. Mr. Martin, you have 15 minutes. Please go ahead. Make sure you introduce yourself for the record, because an audio recording of this argument will be posted online after we're done. Thanks. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Xavier Martin, Martine, appearing on behalf of Ms. Shanley. I would first note for the record that my office, whether it's a procedural mistake on our end, was not aware of this hearing. We were just made aware through a phone call by the Court of Appeals staff. I would note that our staff at my particular office, since January 1st, is checked in every 2 to 3 weeks. We take transcripts of all our phone calls, so we certainly have paperwork to back that up. I was also told that I would be emailed Zoom information, yet I have yet to receive an email from the court. So whether it's a bad email, honestly, Your Honor, I'm kind of at a loss for words. However, I will do my best to answer any questions the court may have, and I would apologize ahead of time for the circumstances that I find myself in or that I've put the court in. With that said, Your Honor, the written submission by my office, I believe, sums up quite clearly what our position is. There's a number of questions that, you know, we do address in our written submissions. Number one, does Minnesota Statute 634.20, does it even include civil cases? And I think there's an argument to be made both ways. I think we do the best to our ability, precise way of showing that not only does State versus Copeland not exclude civil matters from admitting prior incidents of domestic abuse under Minnesota Statute 634.20, but if we look at the plain language of 634.20, it does And I believe the court, looking at it closely, would find that it was meant to and intended to by the legislature to include any civil matters. In addition, we do note that absent any prejudice by Mr. Osgood, the admission of challenge testimony provides no basis for reversal. I did have an opportunity to hear Mr. Westrick note that in his opinion, there was no harmless error. And I did have an opportunity to hear some of the oral argument with regard to whether there is or isn't a basis for an order for protection and what Mr. Westrick's theory was. However, I would note that that's simply his opinion and nothing more. That's simply his theory and nothing more. We had drawn out testimony from many parties, and the court went into quite a bit of detail of why they found that there was indeed domestic abuse. They noted a detailed factual basis. And with regard to any prior incidents of domestic abuse, that was a very, very small part of the final order. So were the court to decide that Minnesota Statute 634.20 did not include prior domestic incidents to be allowed, we believe that it would still be a harmless error based on the court's own decision-making and based on their factual analysis of why they made that decision.
Can I ask you this? You know, one of the primary arguments made by the appellant is there are no cases where that indicate that this statute's to be utilized in civil cases. I mean, can you cite to any cases or cite to any authority that definitively resolves the issue?
Your Honor, specifically nothing that definitively resolves. I believe I'd cited a case that had never been published, so it's not certainly not an authoritative case. However, it goes both ways. There's no cases that say otherwise. And I've noted in the written arguments why that is. So I believe in many ways, this really is a fresh topic for the courts to consider. And quite frankly, could drastically change a lot of how future civil cases are tried when we look at whether or not prior domestic violence occurrences would be admitted as evidence.
So you think this is a matter of first impression in terms of whether it applies in all civil cases?
Yes, Your Honor, specifically. If I note back to the written submission, specifically page 2, it is paragraph C titled Analysis and then subdivision A. First, it notes State versus Copeland and why that State versus Copeland, while it is authoritative, actually does not exclude civil matters from admitting prior incidents of domestic abuse under Minnesota Statute 634.20. So, Your Honor, to answer your question specifically, this really is a new topic for the courts to consider. And I think could in many ways, one way or the other, drastically change the way that we may try civil cases when it comes to any allegations of domestic abuse.
Well, what about the argument of Mr. Westrick that the use of the word accused is usually in the context of a criminal matter? And that he reads that as being an indication that the legislature intended it to be used in criminal matters. How do you respond to that argument?
Certainly, Your Honor. If we look at specifically beginning on page 3, it would be paragraph C and then subparagraph B as in Bravo, titled The Plain Language of Minnesota Statute 634.20 Allows It to Apply to Civil Matters. It goes into somewhat direct analysis of paragraph by paragraph backing it with case law as to why words including accused, and when we look at the totality of the entire statute and how it's used, really does show that the legislature intended for civil matters to be included in this particular statute. And Your Honor, if I may continue. Overall, we have a number of issues. First, we have the interpretation of the statute, which will have a much, in my opinion, greater effect of as I've previously noted, how civil cases are tried in the state of Minnesota. But in addition, in a much more micro level, we also consider whether when we look at the totality of all the evidence produced, when we look at the overall court order and the analysis, which goes into quite a bit of detail compared to other order for protection court orders that I've seen in the past as to why they had the finding that they did, it is noticeable that the mention of any prior domestic violence related offenses, or at least allegations of such, are really a minor part of the overall finding of the court. And any arguments as to, you know, extreme statements like, well, there is no evidence otherwise, that is, I would argue, just the opinion of Mr. Westrick, but certainly not the opinion of the court. And the court showed so by its own words in its own court order. So if we give discretion of the court as to whether preponderance of evidence and whether domestic abuse was found or not, reaching that burden, we really see that that was a very, very small factor and that there was more than enough evidence, given the court's own logic, whether it's my logic, whether it's Mr. Westrick's logic, the judge did find that there was domestic evidence and went into quite a bit of detail why. So, Your Honors, the main questions we have before the court today are, number one, the macro level. Does Minnesota Statute 634.20 apply to civil matters? And does it allow prior domestic violence-related offenses, or at least allegations of it? Does it allow that kind of evidence into these kind of hearings? I believe that, as I previously noted, this really is a brand new question for the court that has never just been flat out directly asked. I believe if we look at the statute, for the reasons mentioned in the written submission, we'll see why the legislature did intend for civil matters to include prior incidents of domestic violence, or at least evidence of such. In addition, why current standing court cases in the state of Minnesota don't negate civil matters from allowing such. And therefore, this really is a new question for the court to consider. And then in addition, as I previously noted in the micro level, even if the court were to disagree with my definition of 634.20 and how that applies to civil matters, again, this really is a harmless error in that there's so much that went into the final decision of the court as to why domestic violence occurred that the court would have still found otherwise. And you don't have to take my word for it. You don't have to take Mr. Westrick's word for it. You can literally look at the wording of the court and how much detail they went into. If the court has no further questions, I would like to rest any oral arguments. And if Mr. Westrick doesn't have an opportunity to rebuttal, then I would just ask the court a brief opportunity for myself as well. Thank you.
Mr. Martin, we don't allow respondents time for rebuttal. So if there's anything else you want to add now, please proceed.
Thank you kindly, Your Honor, for clarifying that. Your Honor, I would just lastly note that I believe that our written submissions went into quite a bit of detail, and I would ask the court to take consideration into that as well. I think the main questions that have come up today, and these particular proceedings are all directly addressed in the written submissions backed by case law. And at least my office's interpretation of what both that case law and statutes state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. And sorry you weren't aware of this oral argument this morning. As far as our court records show, all the proper notices went out. I think it's the first time something like this, anybody has claimed something like this. So at any rate, I don't know what happened on your end, but thank you for your arguments. And I just want to reassure you that we already have carefully reviewed the briefs and the record in this case, and we certainly will do so. So thank you. Mr. Westrick, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm always, I always smile at this, both in criminal and in civil cases, when someone fights to get something in and it's very important and they argue very hard to get in. And then after it gets in and then maybe it shouldn't have gotten in, then they say, oh, it was nothing. Then why did we fight so hard? But if the court looks at page 3 of the OFP, paragraph 4 alpha, you're going to see that this was not harmless error, this evidence. The court relies on it, mentions it several times, says it's a basis for its decision. And once it does that, it demonstrated that it's not harmless error. I'd also direct the court's attention to pages 8 to 10 of our brief, where we talk about the fact that in order for circumstantial evidence to be sufficient, it has to predominate over any other theory. And the fact that a person, if they can't show how something happened, then generally it is a directed verdict. And I'd like the court to look at those
cases. Mr. Westrick, are you familiar? I think it's Staub v. Myrtle Lake, a relatively recent-ish, within the last year or so, decision of the Minnesota Supreme Court, where they said, in fact, you know, didn't know why the woman fell down the stairs and there were no witnesses, and said that's a question of fact for the fact finder. So I'm not sure that is the law, Mr. Westrick. Do you have any cases to cite to us on that point?
Well, I did, Your Honor. I cite them in my brief, and they talk about that. If you know, in that case, I thought that the only evidence was she fell down the steps. There was no one that saw it, but there really wasn't any other theory as to why the circumstantial evidence predominated. And that's the point that I'm raising. But, you know, if you look at the Hanrahan case that I cite on page 7, or the Ferguson case that I cite on page 7, where it says lack of evidence as to how accident happened will warrant a directed verdict. So, I mean, there are some cases out there that go on. But again, it has to predominate. But my last point about I do want to just read the quote that I did from State v. Copeland. By the statute's plain language, meaning 63420, the statute applies only in cases where a person is charged with domestic abuse and the state intends to introduce evidence of prior domestic abuse involving the accused and the victim of the currently charged offense. And that's a direct quote from this court in the published Copeland case. That's not my interpretation.
But was the issue that you raised, was that raised in the Copeland case? Were they actually deciding that in that case?
Well, in the Copeland case, the decision was whether or not the evidence in Copeland was directed towards someone other than the victim of the domestic abuse. And this court said, because the evidence was directed at someone other than the victim of the domestic abuse, that it was not admissible and did not meet the statutes. But I do understand that this very well may be dicta, but it is the only case that I found that goes directly on point with this. And I also note again that when you use the term accused, and if you look at chapter 634, I point this out in our first footnote, there's only three statutes in Chapter 634 that talk about civil cases. And in each of them, they start with, in any civil or criminal case. And so I disagree with Mr. Martin. I believe that the statute is limited to criminal cases. But I do agree with him that it isn't really very clear. And so this court will need to resolve that issue. Unless the court has any other questions, I will thank the court for its time and attention to the matter on behalf of myself and my client. And just note on a side note that I've been where Mr. Martin is before it happens. Thank you.
All right. At least when we were in practice, we all had nightmares about that, if nothing else. Any further questions from the panel of Mr. Westrick? Not seeing any. I thank you both, Mr.